Hi everyone, welcome to All Things Creative. I'm your host, Linda Riesenberg Fissler. I'm here today with a very good friend and I guess I could say longtime friend. We've known each other for a few years now, Michael Harding. And Michael creates my favorite paints in the world. And I'm not just saying that because he's on my podcast. He knows that he actually helped me break through and start painting in a little bit different direction. I mean, he basically asked me one question a while ago. It was, what did I think was holding me back, or something similar than that? I always thought it was my skills that were holding me back, but it actually wasn't. It was my paint, and we'll get into a little bit of that. We've talked about that on previous shows as well. But welcome, Michael. It's so good to talk to you again.
Hi, Linda. Hi, everyone. Lovely to be here.
So, okay, Michael. So, tell us what new products you have.
Oh, I've been having a great time. I've been playing around in my color mill. I think I might be becoming a bit of a mad scientist on this. I mean, everyone keeps telling me that. And I'm like a kid in a toy store when I'm in there. I just get an idea and off I go for weeks trying to track down colors and stuff like that. But anyway, yeah, I'm in the process. I'm about to launch two new colors, my quinacridone gold and indigo. The quinacridone gold, of course, has got quinacridone pigments in. It's got two of them, and it's also got a pigment yellow 150. It has the most wow. It's one of these crazy situations. I mean, it's probably like the whole idea of talking to you on a radio and talking about color. I suppose it's a crazy thing to do anyway, because all right, you get the photographs, but there's very little you can see. It's one of those colors that looks like sunset in a tube. Incredibly powerful, incredibly beautiful, and it just streams sunshine. Or it's just, for me, it's a color I've been wanting to do for years. Other makers make a number of varieties, and I just decided to put my own spin on it on this occasion. So please look out for this. Also, indigo, yet again, another color which people have asked me to do for years. It has to be a mixture of modern pigments, because the natural dye stuff made from a number of plants from the tropics is far too fugitive. But it has that characteristic nice reddy blue that we tend to be familiar with more on sort of the color of your jeans. Yeah, it's just one of those go-to colors. Great for anything from, oh, as I sit here, I'm thinking, why couldn't you use it in a portrait? But sort of grays for landscapes, skies, of course. It's a very sort of sultry, deep, rich, bluey black. It doesn't have the same, how could a color almost as black as black have the same zing as something like sunshine in a tube, as I would call it, with a quinacridone. But they both have really something unusual about them. They both come with the usual, dare I say, MH color intensity. And woe betide you if you get it on your clothes, but there we go. Sort of a good sign in a way, because of course, when something's got really huge tint power, it means you're getting real bang for bucks there in terms of the pigment load. It just goes on and on.
Yes, it does. Yeah, so those are the
Relatively fast drying.
So those are your two new colors, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so no new colors in the oils other than those two, right?
Just those two, but I'm in the process of making another cobalt teal,
Oh,
a
oh.
slightly cooler shade than the other one. It's funny because, sorry guys, before we came on the air, we naturally as old friends we were catching up, like, hey, what have you been painting on recently? And Linda mentioned she'd been trying my existing cobalt teal as an unusual color for her in her palette. So I've just given her the news. There will be another cobalt teal, slightly different, cooler shade than the existing one. I was recently staying with, I was lucky enough to go down to New Zealand, and I was staying with a remarkable artist, a guy called Tim Wilson, who's also a personal friend. And my, can that man use cobalt teal in his skies? You know when you see those sunsets, and you get that sort of green color that shouldn't be there, that's just somehow above the horizon. I looked at his paintings and just said, how are you doing that? And he said, cobalt teal. No way. Because it just, the cobalt teal just looks so dense. The way he uses it, he just makes it sort of dance through the color. Even though I saw him do it, I still don't know how he did it. It's one of those miraculous things when you watch an artist who has deft of hand. And he just made that color sing like you won't believe.
I got to interrupt you. I'm sorry. Echoing. But anyway, the interesting thing about cobalt teal is every one of my students in my class has fallen in love with cobalt teal.
Yeah.
And then it is a palette expander for me. So I want to get into a little bit of that, but we'll talk that after we get done talking a little bit about your products. But yeah, it was one of these things. I think I was always saying, you know, you have to make that boat color, like the boats up in St. Andrews by the Sea in Canada, Newfoundland, and print, you know, Edward Island and Nova Scotia. And they have this really, like, you know, greenish cobalt teal type color to them. And it's a hard color to mix. And you came out with the cobalt teal, not because of me, I'm absolutely sure, but you always heard that from me. And you came out with that color, and I have used it for everything except boats.
Right.
So yeah, skies. I've used it in sea, make you know, ocean colors. I've used it on just throwing it up in the background of something, just to give it some, you know, great interest. And it's just the painting that I had just finished is a painting of a woman in France sitting at a table, and she's giving some sass to one of the waiters. And I've just thrown it into the atmospheric background behind her, because the whole painting is about her with her one finger up saying, like, just wait a minute, you know, I'm going to tell you what I want type of conversation. And it's just directs. I used it, like I said, atmospherically, just to kind of direct the eye around the painting a little bit. And it's just amazing what it does. And every one of my students have told me to tell you, don't you ever stop making that color. You'll have all of us upset with you. But now I hear there's a new one coming out. So tell us about that one a little bit more.
Okay, well, it's going to be a cooler shade. Again, it's crazy to describe color on the radio. But wait and see. Wait and see.
Yeah.
A work in progress.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be every bit as exciting as the existing one. And I wasn't intending to talk about that today. That's a bit of a can out of the bag, I have to be honest.
Okay, well, we appreciate that. I always like being first out there with the news. So so we've got the two colors. Now, do you want to talk about one of the other, your jar products? I'll just say that for this point.
All right.
Which one?
Yeah, I've been exploring more impasto mediums. A lot of people ask me for gel-like materials, and there's a very simple way of providing art to this one. This one's based on silica. Mm. So it's very gel-like, has the appearance almost of a solid honey. It's great for incorporating in with paint, for adding body to brush strokes, at the same time retaining transparency. Average speed drying, and you can see in that little picture there, mm-hmm. How it increases the translucency. Look where you get the sort of the yellowy, hazy thing coming out, a bit like, you know, the old days of the I don't know how many of you out there are guitarists. Well, you see what was a sunburst color on old electric guitars, mm-hmm. Les Pauls, Stratocasters. It reminds me a bit of that, where you can get that. It almost looks as if it's been airbrushed in that picture, actually, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I love colors which go. Sorry, I'm back to talking about color. Forgive me a second.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I love colors that go. They have several characteristics. You know, in the mass tone, they're one thing, and the transparent, they're another, and then you can get them to do other things when you intermix them with things. And I like surprises. I call them journeys. I like colors which take me on a journey that aren't completely predictable, particularly when you mix with other things. I'm not saying that you get something different when you mix yellow and red. Of course, you're going to get an orange, but you get a moment where there's a bit of a surprise takes place. And of course, on other occasions, you want complete predictability. if you're a portrait artist and you're about to deliver a brushstroke onto someone's cheek, and you know you're figurative, of course you want 100% predictability. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I think that when you're on the palette and you're playing around and you get little surprises, that's what for me makes painting interesting. And I think really as painters, we all have to think of ourselves as entertainers. Mm-hmm. We entertain the eye as the eye wanders around a canvas. I think it's one of those things that if you were able to plot where the eye roams around a canvas, it'd be quite surprising. And you get caught on little lisps of paint, little color nuances that just fascinate the eye and so therefore entertain. But anyway, coming back to the gel, you can see there in that photograph that the gel lends itself wonderfully. When you have those particularly transparent colors within oils, it has the ability to really make them sing, almost fluoresce. So I'm particularly excited about launching this. It will be available in the United States probably within the next month.
Great.
It's probably on a boat as we're speaking at the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I use it in my own painting. As you can probably imagine, when I play around with these things and develop them, I naturally test drive them on artists, friends, and so on. And I've also demoed in quite a few places and have a little bit of a jar there as a teaser for the audience. And in fact, I was recently down in Australia and New Zealand, and it got to the point where my jar had so many fingers poked into it and so many brushes poked and palette knives, it was starting to look like, if you've got kids, you'll know what I mean, where you've got butter and just about everything comes in there off their knives. The gel was starting to look like that. The impasto medium was starting to look like lots of different colours were creeping in. So I decided to leave it with an artist friend, also in Australia. Mm. It didn't make it home because it got so dirty with people delving into it.
Right.
But it does conjure a certain amount of excitement. And I think it's really interesting. For those of you who also tend to suffer from headaches from various mediums, you probably won't have to worry with this because it's essentially, as I said, silica and linseed oil. Mm. There's no turpentine in this. It's going to be known as PM7, paint medium number 7, earlier impasto medium. Now, just to sort of recap on that, all the previous 6 to some degree contain turpentine. So if you are of the disposition that unfortunately you do get headaches, mm-hmm. You won't have to worry with this, I don't think anyway. Wow. Anyway, always paint with the windows open, so just to sort of help negate any problems like this.
Right.
Another thing which I'd love to talk about is our new acrylic primer. And I philosophically like to refer to it as an acrylic primer rather than a gesso, because I think that it's not fair to use the word gesso with acrylics. I mean, maybe I'm being a bit of a stickler for detail. Some of you who are knowledgeable on art materials will, of course, know that traditional gesso is made by chalk and rabbit skin glue or hide glue. Chalk being, of course, calcium carbonate. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways to make a material using an acrylic resin and chalk and calling it acrylic gesso is a little, I don't know, it just doesn't seem to work for me. So I prefer to think of these things as primers. But the reason a lot of people might think, well, come on a second, what's Michael Harding doing playing around with acrylics? If you were able to be a fly on the wall in my office, my studio, wherever I receive my emails or phone calls, you would hear that something like 20% of the calls I get, the concerns that people voice are always around primers and how to treat their supports. And absolutely, it's fundamental, of course, to the whole process. They should be concerned. But the struggles, therefore, that people have. And over the years, the recurring comment I've had is usually starts like this. Oh, Michael, yeah, I love your paints. And I've noticed for some time that I can do a great painting in the studio. It looks great on the day, but then I return to my studio the next day and all the colours have gone dull and matte. Why is that? And as I say, it's a very, very reoccurring theme. I usually ask the question then, are you painting on an acrylic primer or acrylic gesso? And they said, yeah, how do you know? Now, the problem generally with most acrylic gessos primers is that they are porous and therefore they tend to absorb, they suck like a sponge the oil out of the oil paint and render it matte looking, the surface dulls. So this is what people are witnessing. And of course, there's a number of tricks you can use to alleviate this anyway. Sometimes just simply putting a nice substantial ground of a nice paint with a body down as a secondary sort of primer down over the acrylic primer will of course block this drawing out of the oil. Or I know artists also sometimes will lay the canvas down flat on a table and then spread on a very liberal amount of linseed oil, which quenches the thirst of the canvas. And then, of course, they have to wipe it completely dry clean with rags and paper towels accordingly so that they don't have a greasy layer, so that the thirst of the primary material is quenched. But there's no residue on the surface because, of course, when we structure paintings, we have to be very careful and very aware that we want good interface between the surfaces of the various paint layers as we proceed. And to leave a nice greasy surface would not be the best thing we could be doing for a number of reasons. It would go against the fat over lean, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's one simple technique. Now, it took me probably 4 years to develop this. The search was mainly finding the acrylic resin which would actually work for this. Ironically, there's a little known piece of my history. All those years ago when I was back at college, I had a particular college professor. His name was Graham Beeching. And Graham had an animation paints company. He was making paints for the animation industry. Not surprisingly, I spent a lot of time hanging out with Graham, and that's where I got the sort of the if you like, the trigger that yes, artists can make their own paint. And of course, Graham was very knowledgeable, and he taught me the principles of actually making these acrylic paints for cartoons. That was his main occupation. So yes, acrylic primers aren't exactly unknown to me. I have to also say that, of course, being an oil artist myself, I heavily favour oil over acrylics because I tend to find that oils, you just can't get the luminosity that you, sorry, with acrylics, you can't get the luminosity that you can with oils anyway. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I'm heavily biased, but I do admire the versatility and the speed at which an acrylic primer can function. In an ideal world, of course, I'd love everyone to be rabbit skin gluing and lead priming, of course, but I realise there's a reality and a restriction upon people's time, and people will be thinking, oh, yeah, this Michael Harding, he just rants on and on and on and on about his historic methods, but hey, you know what, I just want to get on with things. So, yeah, we developed this acrylic primer called non-absorbent acrylic primer because, as I stress, although it has good interphase, in other words, when you apply a layer and it dries, and when you apply the next layer of your oil paint, there's good interphase. It's non-absorbent, or hardly, maybe 1% of the oil is actually drawn into the acrylic prime surface, so that it means that the colours retain that luminosity, that lusciousness. I mean, from my own point of view as an oil artist, I like to think that when I put a brush stroke down and I step back and go, yeah, that one works, that's a good one, I want to know that brushstroke's going to remain unchanged for years, mm-hmm. because that's the statement I've left. And to think of it, and I've struggled myself with this, where you paint on a prime surface and it just sucks the living daylights out of the oil paint and makes them look dull and terrible. So yes, this is why we brought this to the market. Works exactly like other acrylic primers, gessos. Dries in about 20 minutes, dilute the first coat a bit with water, maybe 20%, something like that, just to get greater flow, greater penetration of whatever your support is. Of course, it works wonderfully on linen, or should you be using cotton duck? I frown slightly upon cotton duck. I wish people would step up from it. Wood, MDF, you name it. People have contacted me and say, hey, it's all right on cardboard, but come on, everyone, think. Cardboard's not exactly the most robust of materials anyway. Do your painting a favour. At least work on a wooden panel. I know everyone likes that spontaneous thing, but just always consider what you know. Ironically, and Linda and I was just sort of discussing this before we came on air, sometimes when you're painting and you do something which is not normally your MO, your mode of operandi, or operandum, happy things can come along because you're not sort of, you don't seem to be so sort of formally concentrating and thinking about things. And somehow, this is where the magic, the mystery of painting can surprise us, and little gems can suddenly come along because we're not being so formal about the process. So yeah, I get it. If you're in your studio and you think, you know what, I don't want to commit a whole canvas to something. Here's a bit of cardboard. I'm just going to put down a foot area of an acrylic primary, and off you go. I understand that, but yeah, it's those happy magic accidents that can often be the best. Incidentally, I'm a little bit guilty as well because some years ago I did a painting on a disposable palette paper. And again, it was that mentality. I was just playing around.
Mm-hmm.
I was just playing around, and everyone comes over and looks over my shoulder and goes, oh, yeah, that's really nice. And of course, after about half an hour, I peeled it off the pad and went to throw it away. And my wife jumped in and said, what are you doing? You can't throw that away. And of course, now I look back and I realize it's one of the best paintings I've ever done. And here I am, Mr. Permanence, and it's painted on disposable palette paper. So, yeah, that's how it goes, I'm afraid, folks. Sometimes the magic comes along when you don't expect it, and it's just, I think it's in some ways, you set up these little magic scenarios of things, but, yeah, please always try and consider your support, because it's fundamental. You can be working with the best paint in the world, but if your support isn't sound, that paint's going to end up on the floor at some point in 100 years anyway by flaking or crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this acrylic primer, very excited about it. We will be adding another, well, in fact, at least two other shades of it as well, a neutral grey, and also a sort of terracotta sienna colour. I've had lots of requests for this. So that for those of you who don't like painting upon a solid white ground, of which I'm one as well, you'll have a couple of neutral things that you can be using. So it'll speed the process. Incidentally, I think most artists, even if you have a white canvas, you tend to kill that white surface by just smudging on a favoured colour and just killing off that intensity of white. I think we'd all say that. I was going to say something else that just slipped out of my head for that moment there. Anyway, Linda, I hope I've covered all of that thing to do with the acrylic primer. I mean, it essentially just behaves like everyone else's acrylic primer, except it doesn't suck the oil out, which I think is great.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. And it's. Do you have me on speaker, Michael?
I do.
Okay, that's why I'm echoing. It's strange. Okay, so yeah, so I always get asked that question by my students. You know, should I be priming this? I had one person that took a really cheap canvas material that she bought at a store, and then she turned around and gessoed on top of it. And I'm like looking at her going, why are you going through all this pain? It's like, because the support that you have on it's going to disappear before that gesso does. So like, you know, go up in your grade of, I mean, I could even be duck that she was painting on at the time, but I was like, you know, get into the painting part of this.
So many people tend to make the materials their enemy rather than their friend.
Right.
And once you're trying to do something to cure something, to cure something else, to cure something else, oh, wow, you're just finding you've got a war on, a battle on.
Right.
All these materials should be your friends, so that the whole process of painting is a bit like eating.
Mm-hmm.
You can't wait to taste and put the next morsel in your mouth. It has to be luscious in a way. And I mean, some artists again have asked me, they say, well, look, Michael, I've bought a cheap canvas. It's obviously primed in a something that is going to absorb the oil out. Can I put a layer of your stuff over it? Yes, you can.
Mm-hmm.
But as you've correctly recognized, Linda, why don't you just step up and sort the thing out from the start anyway?
Right.
I mean, in an ideal world, I'd love everyone to actually be priming and sizing or stretching and acrylic priming their own canvases anyway, because as I've voiced many occasions, I feel that the closer you can be to your materials in terms of being hand-on, the greater craftsperson you are, which reflects also in your artwork, because it sort of shows. And I mean, I'm sorry if I'm being cliché for everyone, but it's one of those things. The more understanding you, for instance, have of a car engine, the better a driver you are.
Mm-hmm.
From a carpenter's point of view, go to the forest, look at a tree. The greater understanding you have of a tree, the better carpenter you will be. And I think that's also the case with stretching and handling all of your art materials. The greater the understanding, greater the knowledge, the greater the painter you will be. I do get very frustrated when we've just come back from talking a lot to artists at the plein air convention over in Santa Fe, and then I went straight over to the Port D.C. and I've lost my train of thought. What was I talking about, Linda?
We were talking about supports, and you were just talking to a number of artists at Pace and then the Portrait Society. And I think you were probably going in the direction of what the artists were painting on, maybe?
Yeah. Well, I think it's obvious to all out there that sort of the greater the understanding that you can have both historically and practically in your materials, the greater artist craftsperson you will be, without doubt.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question for you, Michael. I can't stretch canvas, mainly because I'm getting some arthritis in my knuckles and stuff. So I want to go out and buy the best produced stretched canvas I can. So I try to find the ones that are oil primed on linen. Is that a good support, or should I be looking at something else?
Yeah, the only thing that worries me about oil primed is they're invariably alkyd based.
Okay.
And that worries me slightly. Not that I've got any thing huge against alkyd resins. Of course, it's a man-made synthetic resin.
Right.
But it tends to be quite a greasy surface. Paint slides around it in a bit, and it might not be the best. I think that if you are acquiring pre-primed, oil-primed, then you should try and specify that it is actually linseed oil-based.
Okay.
And again, from my own point of view, even if someone put it into my hands a fine oil-primed linen canvas, and I'd like the springiness, the drumminess of it, and I thought, well, here we go, I would automatically start putting down another layer of paint over it just to make my own foundation. God, I feel a bit like I sound a bit like a dog making a bed for itself, where I just want to scratch up the grass and leaves a bit and sort of lie down in them. That's also in some ways how I feel about when I start a painting.
Okay, so it's not the worst support I could find, but if I look for something with a linseed oil base, it probably would be better. And I know it is Belgium, and it's Belgium linen. So, I mean, you know, and you have made me step up. I mean, I used to get acrylic primed linen or canvas, actually, just regular canvas. And I've been, since I've moved to your paints, I've moved up and went to Belgium linen and oil primed. But I wish I could stretch my own, but I can't.
I feel for you there. Sorry on that one. There are some very good linen producers around the world. We know where the stuff comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ask them, insist to them. I mean, maybe if they're not doing a linseed oil based primer, they could be persuaded to. It would just probably be the curing time. Now, the other thing that concerns me about, of course, an alkyd resin is that there's only one time I've ever played around with it, and that was when, some of you might know the artist Howard Hodgkin, he asked me to produce, believe it or not, he asked me to produce some paint that he could paint some of his house. And as he was a friend, there was a particular sap green that I was doing. This is back in the 1990s. He said he loved the sap green because it reminded him of the color of menus in Paris in the 1940s or 50s. And then he said that the cadmium orange, and I thought, what on earth is he doing with it? And he had a house in Dieppe, and he said that he was painting the beams of the house orange and the outside window shutters he wanted to be this particular green. So I made him a few liters of this material, and I had to make it with Alkyd because I tried it with linseed oleum, and of course it was taking forever to dry. And as I say, the problem with an Alkyd is it needs so much artificial dryer, metallic dryer, that concerns me. Mm. Okay. But that's another pet worry of mine, of course. We're digressing off. So, Alkyds raises my eyebrows slightly. I think that those fine producers, you know, the Belgian linens and various other linens that are produced in the United States by people like Fredericks and Clausens, and, you know, we know the names.
Right, right.
If they're not already making an actual linseed oil based one, it would be good. And gosh, I'd love to be able to supply them a lead primer as well, because that would be to know that people could actually go and buy a lead based primer. And before people start jumping up and down thinking, oh, it's poisonous. Well, it's only poisonous if you eat it. And don't sit there chewing the corner of your canvas like a 6 month old, and you will not get poisoned.
Yeah.
Simple as that. And it produces such a nice, fine, workable surface, and you're straight back into the traditions of the old masters. Mm-hmm. The choice is yours. But no, if those companies could be encouraged. I'm just voicing my own opinion, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I totally forgot what I was going to ask. Oh, no, it went out again. So anyway, to move on, we're both having this problem today. So I know what it was. I wanted to ask you if this bottle, that's your PM7. So that's what the Oleo Impasto, right? Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's what that bottle looks like. So I wanted to make sure that I got every one of your slides on so that people could take down your stuff. One of the questions that I'm always asked about, Michael, is when the painting is dried, 6, 7, 8 months out, year out, you produce varnishes, right? To varnish the painting after it's
We produce currently two. We're developing a third. We produce a matte varnish. We produce a gloss varnish. The matte varnish is straightforward and simple. It appears to dry in 2 or 3 minutes. And that's because the wax that's within it, which gives it the matte quality, solidifies, and therefore it changes from being a liquid to a solid. Just to sort of give people the correct description, a matte varnish comes looking like a cloudy liquid. And in our case, it is beeswax dissolved within turpentine. Now, because once beeswax is at room temperature, it solidifies, mm-hmm. it gives the varnish its cloudy appearance. So what you have to do is slightly warm it. And I mean, don't go and put it in a microwave or on I have to say this because people do. They think, well, that's the quickest and easiest way. Please don't do that. The easiest way, of course, is to take a skillet or a pan, as we say in the UK, boil a kettle of water, pour in about sort of 2 inches of really intensely hot water, and just place the jar of the varnish within it, and you'll find after 5 or 10 minutes, the cloudiness disappears as on a microscopic scale, all the beeswax particles melt, mm-hmm. and therefore render the material clear looking, and then it's ready to paint on. Sorry, to varnish on. I always think it's best to paint with the painting flat. It's just that so often you can find that if you aren't being really vigilant, as your hand goes into the jar, as you approach the canvas, if the canvas is in an upright position, you can find that you can have a few dribbles come off the end of the brush you haven't noticed. Oh, and also do trouble to use a proper varnishing brush. Mm-hmm. Don't use whatever you happen to have knocking around because invariably it won't be 100% clean, and you can have, I've heard of some disasters happening where you'll have the colour leaching into the varnish, and if you're doing the varnishing in an environment where it's not a good light, you might not notice, and the next day when there is a good light, you step back and you've suddenly got a tinted, you've created a glaze, if you like. So that avoid that if you can. Yes, have designated varnishing brushes. I was always taught to work from the centre of the painting out, and I've never known exactly why. I don't think it really matters, but make sure, again, even if the painting's done flat, you're not letting drips and dribbles go unnoticed as you bring the brush across. A varnish is essential, and it doesn't matter if you take a year or two to wait to apply it. As many of you will know, a varnish is designed as a temporary coat. It's a coat which is designed to block the dirt from getting direct contact with the painting, and so is removable by restorers. So when your painting 100 years later is hanging in a national collection somewhere, and the restorers come along and decide it's had so much dirty city air and now's the time to give it a clean, what they do is they'll use solvents to remove the varnish, and it takes the dirt with it. And of course then we're into other conversations about the reason why you take 6 to 9 to 12 months or even longer is because you want the varnish layer to be a completely different layer from the various layers of the painting. In fact, if you look in the Ralph Mayer book, there's one of the occasions Ralph Mayer actually makes a mistake is where he, can you still hear me, Linda?
Yep, I can hear you.
Okay, so my screen just went onto pause, rest, whatever you like to call it, screensaver.
Mm-hmm.
Train of thought.
Varnishing and keeping the, making sure the painting itself is dry so that you don't, when you're removing it, when you're cleaning it.
Yeah, Ralph Mayer. Ralph Mayer, dare I say, makes a little bit of a mistake where he talks about varnishing using Damar varnish. This is something I have to be, I'm looking at myself in the mirror very, very harshly here because we do make a Damar varnish, which I must be honest, I'm reviewing its true mechanisms because if you're a glaze painter and you're glazing away using a Damar glaze, of course, the difference from anything. So, of course, there is this potential that restorers can start to remove the varnish coat, also taking other coats and layers with it,
mm-hmm.
and therefore colour. So and I think this is where Ralph Mayer also makes a little bit of a mistake. So we're considering other options here and developing other varnishes which won't incorporate themselves. And yes, just to reiterate, the reason why you leave it a year or two is so that the layers of the paint are completely dry, so that there's no chance that the varnish coat being oil based can remobilize any of the colors themselves.
Right. Okay.
Another topic, which I is a fairly open secret, Linda.
Okay.
We are going to be launching watercolors.
That's what I was going to ask you about. And that's where I was tripping over myself because I wanted to ask you that in the green room and I forgot and I didn't want to say something, if you.
No, that's.
So.
It's a reasonably open. In secret. It's something I've been working on for over 20 years. And I'm getting to the heady age of 59 now, and I although I don't intend to be retiring anytime soon, in terms of things that I've got left that I can do, yes, of course I can add mediums and I can add varnishes, but I've so loved my oil paint making years, and of course I wish I could do it all again, and of course the obvious one to do it with would be to be with watercolors. Mm-hmm. And so we've been having a really wonderful wild time for particularly the last 2 years because we decided to really push for it, go for it. And so the range hopefully will be launched either at the end of this year or the beginning of 2019. We're looking at a size range somewhere between 100 and 150-ish colors. Of course, it's going to be closely based upon paralleling the nature of the oils in terms of the color choices and the pigment choices. But the great thing, of course, is that it also gives me huge license to play around and add loads and loads of exotic colors. And yes, you talk about being a kid in a candy store. So I'm actually heading back to the UK tomorrow. As I say, I've been traveling to the portrait show and the plein air show. I'm heading back to the UK tomorrow, for a month or so to really do a hard push on formulating a few more of the watercolors. And so watch this space.
Cool.
I decided that there was no point in just bringing watercolors out for people if they were the same as everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been really laboring hard to have all the same sort of things you'd expect from a Michael Harding watercolor, huge, vivid tint power and all the rest of it. But watercolors, of course, work and behave in a slightly different way. And often tint power, to continually have to water it down, would really be rather counterproductive because of color intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had to use a certain amount of license as well. But the feedback we've got from our artist testers has been astounding. So I'm really excited about this. And as I say, it gives me opportunity to play around with pigments I wouldn't normally. And I actually must be honest, it's also prompted me, because when I'm playing around with these watercolor pigments and stuff, I've been getting in exotic pigments, things that I would never have thought to play around with within the oils, including the new cobalt teal, therefore.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, let's have that in oil as well. So it's also prompted me to, and that's why the indigo and quinacridone gold have come along, actually, funnily enough.
Right.
So the great thing is each range has helped each other. So I'm having a wonderful time at the moment, and I'm open to suggestions. A lot of people have contacted me already saying, oh, are you going to do this color, that color? And I'd like, for the most part, to be able to say, yes, I am. I did actually get today asked if I was going to be doing lemon yellow, which is the barium chromate pigment yellow 31.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say no, because the watercolor range will be completely non-toxic. Because watercolor is a sort of a semi-open paint system, mm-hmm. in terms of the air, I didn't want to have things like leads and vermilions in and things like that. And so I decided at that point there would be no toxic colors. And so the pigment yellow 31, barium chromate, known within my oil range as lemon yellow, which is a toxic color, only toxic if you eat it. It wouldn't be advisable to have it in a watercolor. So sadly, I had to tell an artist this afternoon that particular lemon yellow wouldn't be available.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got some absolutely wonderful things, bismuth vanadates and other yellows, which do the job superbly as well. So, you know, I'm really excited.
Yeah.
Really excited about what's going to come.
Yeah, and you do realize that there's probably some overlay here with some of the oil painters, especially some of the plein air painters, because a lot of them will take watercolors out to do very quick sketches before they actually start their actually oil painting on their, you know, boards or whatever that they're painting on. They'll do some water sketches, so watercolor sketches. So I think there's some overlay there with some of your oil painters. Customer.
Most definitely. I mean, also, I was lucky enough to have a holiday in January, and I chose to take watercolors with me. I couldn't take the entire range of prototypes because I just thought this would be a bit crazy. But I suppose I took about 40 or 50 of the colors. And I was also painting with my good friend Mark Sharsha, who some of you will know. He's a very fine landscaper. Also, he's based in Massachusetts. And he and I painted away for a number of days, and I must admit I was really proud of the range, the watercolors, and Mark was terribly complimentary. Of course, he's already very familiar with my oils.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, to actually, not just from a test point of view in terms of taking a color, spreading it out on paper, squidging it around, putting it between my fingers and seeing how I like it, but to actually go out, render image myself onto paper and try and forget that I've actually made this material as well, and just think like an artist using it and seeing how the colors respond, how they lay down, how they spread, how do they granulate, all those sorts of considerations. I loved it. Through my life as an artist, I've gone through some funny phases in terms of I sort of every 10 years I'll swap from one medium to another.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about it is, I know some artists can do it easily. I can't. and it always makes a fool of me because you know, we get to a point where we're sort of fairly confident in terms of what we can expect of one particular medium, and then you flip to another, and of course you then paint that next one as if it was the other one. And really, they don't like to, well, from my point of view, they don't like to be treated like that. So of course I've gone out and I've tried to load brushes and chunks of paper with dense chunks of watercolor as if it was an oil, and of course that's not what it's about. So I find that if I had to relearn the material, it's really quite extraordinary. Whereas 20, 25 years ago, I only was painting in watercolor, and I got to a point where I felt confident. You know, I knew where I could push it. I knew what it would do. And then you flip back to oils, and of course it all goes away again. It's very, very tormenting.
Yeah.
But then again, that's what we do, isn't it? It's, oh. I think there's a lot of masochism involved in art. And that's that makes matters worse, I think. But there we go. We're our own enemies. We put ourselves through this. It's our choice. We could just stay in the restaurant and not bother to go out painting. But there we go.
Yeah. So I'm sitting here staring at your picture of the indigo, and you have some I don't know if that's your cadmium red or if it's a cat orange in there.
I honestly didn't set that photograph up. One of my team of guys did.
Yeah.
So I from a computer screen, it's hard to tell exactly what that red is.
Yeah, but and it's got me thinking back to our conversation that we started in the green room that I want to come back and get on the record, if we could. One of the things that I think is really interesting is when I start to teach my brand new beginner students, I tend to limit their palette just so that they can start to understand values and things like, and not have to worry about 25 different colors of tubes. But it's really been interesting, at least for the last couple of years for me, is I've started to replace certain colors on my so-called limited palette. So for example, if I take your indigo and replace it in my, you know, take it out or put it next to, I don't even have to take it out, the ultramarine blue or the lapis. That, you know, if you think in terms of, okay, indigo is a blue-black, or dark blue, whatever you want to call that, and you know, start replacing things, that range of colors that you get when you start mixing, just looking at these two coming together, you know, it is so different, and it provides so much. We always tend, I think when I started with a limited palette, I always tended to think that I could only use ultramarine blue. And, you know, of course, then I love your lapis. So I pulled the lapis in and it was like, oh, OK, well, we'll get rid of the ultramarine. We'll put the lapis in. But so, yeah. So I think if you don't limit yourself that way, I guess, is what my message is, you know, a blue is blue. There are 20 different kinds of blues. So kind of, you know, put those on your palette, exchange them out. And then we get into the conversation that we talked about a little bit as well around if you're playing, you're in a different space than if you're trying to produce something that, you know, is going to be the award winner or your best painting yet, or however you want to see it. Don't make it too precious. Just start painting and experimenting, because that's the fun in it. You know, it's to me.
I think when you're, as I put it, off guard and you're informal about what you're doing, that's sometimes where these little gems can come along, because they just, because you're not trying, the mind seems to sort of go off guard, and that's when the magic comes along.
Right.
I think sometimes when we make it very formal, where we go, right, here's the canvas, I'm going to start in a minute, these are my colors, I've spread them out in order how I like them on my palette, and I'm going to start in my normal way, I'm going to do this and that, it tends to somehow stifle the creativity. I think that if you put a wild card in there and just go, yeah, I'm just going to have fun, and I'm just going to make nice marks, I'm just going to respond to what I'm looking at, and you don't try, and you don't try and control, you don't try and make the paint do something, and that's when those happy moments come along that we, oh, it's so elusive. It's even hard to talk about, because right. That's where the magic of art is. And I can remember when I was functioning more as a student, because you know, I must confess nowadays I don't do anything about the amount of painting that I could be doing. I probably do about, you know, maybe 10 paintings a year. The days when I was doing loads and loads and loads, and you look back and there'd be 30 done, and there'd be one that stood out, and right. You can bet your life the one that stood out would be the one that you just didn't, yeah, you know, what the hell, I'm just going to have some fun today, I'm not taking it seriously. That was the one that you least expected to be a winner, and it just, and even when you did it, you didn't know it was, and it's generally only when friends or teachers look at the work afterwards, could even be months later, and go, that one there, that one, that's special, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then, even then, sometimes you can't see it yourself. It's only years later you look back and go, yeah, I get it now. That, now, what was I doing that day? What was the train of thought that I had that brought that one about? And then, of course, the danger sets in when you go, ah, how can I make that happen again? And then, of course, you've just kick-started that process of control again. It's a very, very elusive thing called this thing called art.
Mm-hmm.
It sneaks up on us when we're not expecting it. I mean, you can get it to come out moderately most of the time, but to make it come out splendidly is very, very elusive.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember when I was demonstrating for you down at the Art of the Carolinas, second years, and David came up and said, you know, I don't want you to use your regular palette. I want you to choose colors you never would normally paint with, and I want you to do this painting. And it was totally out of my comfort zone, not to mention that, you know, one of the owners of Jerry's Autoramas watching me paint, but it was different. And I think it even surprised you, because I remember you saying something to me around the, you know, I didn't think that these colors were going to work together, but you made it happen. And I was just like, yeah, I don't know how I did it, and I probably couldn't do it again. It was just one of those special moments, but you know, hopefully David's still enjoying that painting. So.
I'm sure he is. I remember it well.
Yeah.
It was again boats, wasn't it?
It was a watermill up in the St. John's, St. Andrews by the Sea area in Canada was the picture that we worked from.
Right.
So it was like an old, it looked like pretty much like you could go one way or another, an old barn, but it was, you know, it was in the middle of like a canyon with the river and water coming right. from it and everything, and a bunch of trees that were, you know, they weren't green, they were gold. I think I made the trees that in that painting, but.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it was more around, we were talking, you know, value and color relationships at the point in that whole painting than we were, you know, talking about, you know, trees are green and the building's orange or whatever. You know, it was just, I had to step outside of that normal thinking of what things should be and thinking more relationships and value and making it kind of work is what I was really thinking about.
It's a great exercise. I think in some ways artists should all do that. I mean, even if I think we've got to knock this formality off its pedestal.
Yeah.
You become too rigid. And I think it just hones our skills to bring in, as I call it, the odd wild card, the thing you wouldn't normally have in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes you appreciate the things you do normally have in there as well. Of course, it'll recalibrate your senses.
Right. So so I guess Michael and I are encouraging everybody who's going to be listening that, you know, to go out and change some things up a little bit and see what happens with some of these colors. I mean, it's amazing to me, almost to the point where, you know, you come out with all these wonderful new colors, and I'm always hesitant to like add them to my palette or switch them out of my palette. But every time I do, I can honestly say I fall in love with the color that you've produced. That's a given.
Thank you.
And then the other part of it is the expansion in how I'm telling the visual story is just remarkable. It comes from just that one little switch, and it expands your eye. It expands the universe. Most of the time I sit there and have the students are looking over my shoulder when I'm painting this. And they're like, the first question that we always hear is, how did you make that color?
So, yeah.
You know, how did you mix that? And it was, I don't know, you know, but as I always tell them as well, if you mixed it once, you can mix it again. It may take you a little while to get there, but you'll get it mixed again because you did it once. You have to know
Well,
to get, you know, to get back there. So
it's quite easy, really. I call it asking the color questions.
Right.
When you're trying to match colors, it's either redder, bluer, yellower, greener, whatever, or lighter or darker. It's, you ask it questions, and sometimes you suddenly see the answer. I don't want to oversimplify it because that'd be unkind. It can be very hard.
Yeah.
But another way I think about it is that it's a bit like variety of food. If you continually only visit one type of restaurant, be it Italian or Mexican or something like that, and then out of the blue you go to an Indian restaurant, I mean, which I have to say is one of my personal favorites, suddenly your taste buds are stimulated and the whole experience, and then it makes you appreciate the Italian and the Mexican more next time you go back.
Right.
I wish people would experiment and be more liberal, have their eyes and taste buds more open. I think it's also the process of looking. It's if you look and only make yourself see the same things over and over again, you're not going there. You're not going to the right place. You need to look at things as if it's almost the first time you've ever seen them.
Yeah.
Well, and dazzled by the wonderful shock of beauty and reality.
Right. I think there's like an inherent flaw when we're being taught or when we're teaching people, is that we always tend to try and get them to some formulaic way of painting. So you spend your first 20,000 miles of canvas coming up with your style or your voice or whatever. And then we get into that formula of always reproducing that. And it's like, you don't want to, you know, we remember the pain of getting to this place where you create your first gorgeous painting and an award winner, or however you want to say, whatever that measure is for you personally. Yeah. But you've gone this whole bunch of miles to get there. And now all of a sudden we've got that, you know, recognition, whatever you want to call it, whatever that goal is, and you're afraid to step away from it. And it's just, you know, I'm like you, I don't paint as much as I used to paint, but when I do paint, I want to have fun and I want to step outside of what I've learned to push it a little bit so that I can, I mean, I know I can always rein it back in. I've learned enough that I know I can do that.
It's a bit like letting go, as the other phrase goes. I remember when I was a younger guy, I used to dance. Now you wouldn't want to see me dance. and I was completely free. And that's where you've got to get to.
Yep.
It's a very elusive thing. I mean, of course, there are many, many books written on the subject.
There are. So, Michael, we're coming up to the hour that we spent on the air. So I'm going to give you an opportunity.
Yeah,
if there's anything else that you'd like to talk with us about, to bring that up now.
You know what? I think we've pretty well covered the universe of art. The whole color thing we've covered, and I'm flattered that people have interest in my new products. And as I said, I'm very excited about the forthcoming watercolors. I like to think that they have a real wow factor.
Yeah, they do.
So yeah, I mean,
they
always
are.
happy to come and talk color.
Yeah. I'm happy to have, like, reconnected with you both on when we were talking here and before we actually went on the air. So hopefully we'll keep in touch. And I'm basically, I have to tell you, I'm falling in love. Every time I look at that indigo, I keep falling in love with it. So I guess I'm going to have to do, I'll be ordering that one from you probably real soon. So
I thought people would be, and you included, would be gravitating more to the tube of sunshine because it was the more drama one. But however, I must admit the photograph of the nice smoky gray blues as they go down to the bottom right do look very interesting.
Yeah, that caught me. That I have to say that. So,
yeah.
But yeah, both of them.
I mean, again, there's a chunk of sky in that one as well, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much for being here, and I appreciate. your time as always. I know you're busy, and especially when you're getting ready to go back to the UK. So I appreciate you spending time with us and talking with us, and say hello to Karen for me, and hopefully we'll catch you again soon.
Will do. You take care, Linda. Lovely talking to everyone. Thank you. Okay. Thanks for the interest.
Yes. Okay. Bye, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.